listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Knetter, in for Rob Ferret. Our next guest says that much of the water we see today, bodies of water that is, are not in their natural states. Not true wild rivers, creeks, streams, etc. That's because humans have altered and engineered our world to control water. And it's time more of us accept the idea that water is ultimately going to do what it wants. She says that understanding what water wants is one of the keys to adapting to the excessive highs and lows of water that are being caused by climate change. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How connected do you feel to the water where you live? How do you observe or monitor it? Have you been impacted by a flood or a drought, or multiple floods or droughts? What about high lake levels? Have you made a big life change like moving away? Call 800-642-1234, that's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Erica Guise is an independent journalist and National Geographic explorer. She writes about water, climate change, plants, and animals for Scientific American, The New York Times, Nature, The Atlantic, and more. She also co-founded the environmental news startups Climate Confidential and This Week in Earth. Her latest book is called Water Always Wins, Thriving in an Age of Drought and Deluge. Erica, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I want to start by talking about this concept of water not being free. You bring up the phrase free river and talk about the first time you saw one in Alaska. Could you tell us about that moment and why it was so impactful for you?
Yeah, I grew up in California, which is arguably the apex of water engineering. There's just so many dams and irrigation canals and aqueducts, and everything is very tightly controlled. And I was in Denali National Park in Alaska hiking with some friends, and we came to this river that was probably about 40 feet across and fairly fast moving. And we weren't going to be able to cross it. And I looked up the floodplain and it was braided, and there were strands of it that were sort of twining together and apart. And I realized that this is what a river is supposed to look like, not this very straight canal, which is certainly what I had experienced growing up in California. And I think people in a lot of places around the world, you know, the streams and creeks and rivers that they know are quite constrained like that.
That was something that was really interesting to me reading your book, that even things that I might think of as, oh, that's just a natural river, have actually been shaped and molded by humans over time. Can you talk about some of the more natural ways that water wants to move and does move that we might not expect or have forgotten about?
Yeah, I think so. One of the key ideas in my book is slow water. And all of the people in my book who are trying to do things a different way are looking to recreate or restore some of the natural slow phases of water. So think about wetlands and swamps and floodplains, something that people in the Midwest are very familiar with. High altitude meadows and mountains covered with forests that generate rain. These are all places where water in its natural state would be soaking into the ground. And a lot of important things happen when water and the ground interact. It prevents flooding because the ground is absorbing excess water. It supplies water to streams in the dry season because the underground system is very large and complex. And so water very slowly returns to the stream into the dry season. So there are many things like that. And what I think we don't realize is the extent to which we have eradicated these natural slow phases. So here's kind of a mind-blowing statistic. Since 1700, humans have erased 87% of the world's wetlands. So that is a vast, vast area that is no longer able to absorb water in its natural way. And so, when we pave on top of those, we fill them in, we plant on them, then the water just speeds off really quickly. So that causes flooding, and then it also causes drought later. So one of the big points in my book is, yes, climate change is causing these water extremes. It's bringing bigger rainstorms with more water, longer, more severe droughts, 20 years and counting in the US Southwest. But a significant part of these problems we're experiencing with water is our development decisions. So that's urban sprawl, it's industrial agriculture, and it's the concrete control-oriented ways that we've tried to manage water. So the good news about that is there's a lot we can do to change that, even separate from reducing emissions, which of course we also need to do.
One of the things that you wrote about, which is a factor that might actually make flooding worse when it happens rather than its intended purpose of controlling water, is the levee. Can you talk about the levee effect and the research that's going into that?
Yeah, I came across this really fascinating field of study called sociohydrology, and that is just what it sounds like. It's humans and water impact. So for a long time, hydrologists would measure flows in rivers and not really consider what humans were doing. But levees, in fact, have a significant effect on what happens to the water, because of course they're constraining the river and keeping it from its floodplain. So it's well known, even by experts who build levees, that the more levees you put up, the higher the water will be. In fact, flood levels near St. Louis, Missouri, have increased up to 13 feet over the 20th century. And that's largely due to building of levees and restricting access to the floodplain. You know, the water can't spread out, so it just goes higher. It's kind of common sense. But the levee effect is a sociological impact where, you know, you build a levee and humans think, oh, this area is safe. It's protected. It's flooding less often. So more people move in there. They build their businesses and homes there. And levees, water people have a joke, which you may have heard. There are two kinds of levees, ones that have failed and ones that are going to fail. And there are reasons for that, which we can go into if we have time. But when you have all those people living in a floodplain behind a levee, they have this false sense of security. And then when the levee does fail, it's even more catastrophic because more people are at risk.
We're talking with Erica Guise right now, author of the new book, Water Always Wins. And Erica, in addition to the slow water movement today, you also go back in time and look for examples from the past, from the pre-industrial era. One of those that you return to in the book several times is the marsh dwellers in Iraq. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, it's such an interesting civilization. People have been living on top of the marshes in Mesopotamia, right? The Tigris and the Euphrates rivers, the cradle of civilization, for more than 9,000 years. You know, the ancient Sumerian civilization evolved out of the marsh dweller civilization about 6,000 years ago. And people today still live on top of the marshes. They use the reeds that grow there, Phragmites, which is invasive and kind of cursed elsewhere, but it's native there and it's incredibly fast growing and strong. They use it to build their homes, to build their animal paddocks, to build these islands that they live on that are on top of the marsh. And they really view the marsh as the source of all life, and they have a real caretaking attitude toward it. And it just kind of blew my mind, because in dominant culture, you know, we really think of wetlands as wastelands. And often what we try to do is fill them in and build on top of them, you know, make the land worthwhile or make it pay in some way. And yet here people have lived in harmony with wetlands, with marshes, for more than 9,000 years.
We're talking with journalist Erica Guise about her new book called Water Always Wins, Thriving in an Age of Drought and Deluge. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How concerned are you about flooding or droughts where you live? If you live along the coasts here in Wisconsin, have you noticed a change in the water levels or erosion? If you farm, have you been impacted by flooding? How do you think we could do things differently here to account for what water wants to do? What planning would you like to see from the local or state government? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. for listening to Central Time. I'm Dean Knetter, in for Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with journalist Erica Geis, author of the new book, Water Always Wins, Thriving in an Age of Drought and Deluge. Also taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Do you have an experience with flooding you want to share? Do you have questions about how water works and how we can learn to live with it? That's 800-642-1234. Erica, for your book, you spend time with a lot of hydrologists and water engineers, and that includes beavers. I want to talk about beavers. Can you tell us what they do to waterways and what we can learn from them?
Well, they're definitely the cutest water engineers, in my opinion. beavers are semi-aquatic rodents. They prefer to spend most of their time in the water because they feel safe there from predators. And to do that, to have more area in which to harvest food and move around, they build dams, which create ponds. And of course, ponds are a great example of slow water. And there's been some interesting studies about how much water they're moving underground and storing and what impact that can have, how that correlates to a city's water supply, et cetera. And it's more important with climate change, especially in places that rely on mountain snow for water, because there's less of that now. So if you can instead capture that winter water, if the beavers can capture it and move it underground, then again, it will continue to supply natural hydrology, natural streams in the dry season. And the thing about beavers is they can address both flooding and drought. In England, they have a lot of old towns built right along rivers, and they have had a lot of terrible floods across the country in recent years. And beavers were completely eradicated, killed about 400 years ago there. And so now people have brought beavers back in, and they are documenting, researchers are measuring how much it delays the water flow to prevent flooding. So it's kind of like flattening the curve in the coronavirus pandemic, where you want to, you know, try to not get it, and so you don't overload the hospital all at once. And similarly, the beaver slows the water. So it's still, the water is going out, but over a longer period of time to reduce flooding. And then in the Western US and Washington and elsewhere, they're trying to replace the snow storage with beaver storage to help weather droughts. And interestingly, beaver ponds are a really important fire break as well. Obviously, the water isn't going to burn, but they also raise the water table around the pond, which makes more water available to the plants. And so therefore, they're less desiccated and less likely to burn. And historically, beavers were all across the United States. And so it was a much wetter landscape than we think is natural. So if we can help the beaver continue their comeback from when we nearly killed them all, we'll have that resource for us in the Western U.S. where we desperately need more water on the land.
One of my favorite things in the book was a 1950 artistic rendering from the Idaho Fish and Game Service of beavers being parachuted in to mountainous regions to take place in a water restoration project that they were doing.
Yeah, it was so interesting. You know, people have actually realized that how beavers can heal natural water watersheds for at least 100 years. So starting in the 1920s, Idaho, California, they were reintroducing beavers from farming areas where they were getting in farmers' way to mountain areas where they could repair stream systems. And then people kind of forgot about it for a while. But yeah, the parachutes were because it was just after World War II, and some of the areas were so remote that there wasn't really road access to truck in the beavers. And so they tried parachuting them in quite successfully. In fact, there's only one beaver fatality from parachuting that I'm aware of. So it's an interesting experiment.
I want to go to our callers now. We have James in Reedsburg with us. Hi, James.
Hello. So I went to school for wildlife ecology in Stevens Point, and we talked a lot about wetlands and as well as the benefits beavers provide for an ecosystem. And wetlands, I mean, I kind of look at them as like the corals of the land. You know, they have such diverse ecosystems, down from the micro organisms that live there all the way up to the macro organisms. And they're great. They're nature's purifiers. I mean, the water that goes in there is dirt, you know, dirty and brown and can't see through it. And when it comes out, it's crystal clear. It's amazing to see that process.
James, thanks for the call.
I love
Erica, take it away.
Oh, sorry. I was just gonna say, I really love that analogy, the corals of the land. I'm gonna keep that one in mind.
Yeah, we don't have coral reefs here in Wisconsin, but we do have wetlands. And as James said, they have a cleansing effect on the water. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In fact, slow water in its various guises is very important for cleaning water as well. And providing food, like, you know, he was kind of alluding to that with all of the biodiversity that can be found in wetlands. But that's true of floodplains, too. There have been some interesting studies in California with salmon showing that salmon who are allowed to spend time lingering on watery floodplains like they did historically are 12 times fatter. You know, they're better fed. And so they're much healthier and much more able to, you know, weather what comes. And we have this kind of like fish versus farmers debate. But in fact, that's a myth. Like fish and farmers can use the same water and be better for it. They're using it at different times of the year.
I want to talk about some of the ways we can adapt for the future and perhaps relocate, perhaps redesign. What are some of the ways that you're seeing communities do that, particularly here in the Midwest?
Yeah, I think one example that your listeners may be familiar with is Nahant Marsh in Illinois. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. I'm a writer, not a speaker. Yeah, it's near Davenport, Illinois, and it's a wetland that they restored right near the urban area. And during the big 2019 floods, it absorbed as much as a trillion gallons of floodwater. And Davenport did eventually flood a little bit, but less than it would have otherwise. And, you know, the problem is, if you think about that 87% of wetlands that we've removed, you know, water needs a lot of space that it's not getting. So Davenport can do this marsh and they can have a small impact, but what's really needed are marsh restorations along the watershed so that every little bit can, you know, absorb some of it rather than raise the levels like the levee effect that we were talking about. And interestingly, like restoring wetlands on just 1.5% of a landscape can reduce the height and volume of flood peaks by as much as 29%. So it can be a really big bang for the buck. So that's a really great way to make space for water close to human settlements and within human settlements. And then, of course, in some cases, people are retreating from the river when they've flooded repeatedly. And the Midwest is actually the earliest example that I'm aware of this phenomenon in the United States. It's getting a lot of press now in coastal areas because of climate change and sea level rise. You know, there are many rivers in the Midwest, including, of course, the great Mississippi system and Missouri and Arkansas. And so people have dealt with flooding for a really long time and sometimes repeated flooding. If we have time for another story about Soldier Grove, Wisconsin.
Yeah, that seemed to be an instance where relocating a town actually made financial sense.
Yeah. So interestingly, some of these small towns decide together that they're going to move the whole town together. And usually this happens after a series of floods when people are just tired of rebuilding. And they, in the early 80s, they talked to the Army Corps of Engineers because they thought, well, maybe we need a levee to stop all this flooding. And the Army Corps said that it was going to cost $7 million, which was actually triple what the buildings downtown were worth. So they were kind of outraged by that, but also there would be additional ongoing bills forever for the long-term upkeep of the levee, and that would have bankrupted the town. So they collectively decided we're not doing that, and they all moved together.
Erica, in just our last minute or so, adapting to the way water naturally wants to move is going to take a shift, and it's going to take a bit of an ego check for humans in a way. How do you think we should start that shift in reframing the conversation?
Well, you know, the way we relate to water is not mandatory. There are many cultures around the world, including many indigenous cultures, that see water instead of as a commodity or a threat, as a friend or as a collaborator. And I think if you respect water, if we can respect water and understand all of the myriad things it's doing, understand its relationship with the underground, with microbes, with beavers, with humans, you know, we're doing this very kind of linear, single-minded problem solving when we build a dam or a levee. But if we're thinking in systems, if we're thinking of water with respect, asking what water wants, I think that's the shift that we need to live more peacefully and happily alongside water.
Well, we will leave it there. Erica, really interesting stuff. Thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It was a real pleasure.
Erica Guise is an independent journalist and National Geographic reporter. We talked with her today about her new book, Water Always Wins, Thriving in an Age of Drought and Deluge. On the point of water movement, we got an email from Jeff who said, to those who are planning to attend the Farm Technology Days in Loyal, Wisconsin this week, the Wisconsin DNR has a booth with a pretty cool watershed model. Jeff says they're able to show the importance of stormwater management, specifically stormwater ponds, to help reduce peak flow rates. Looks like that event runs today until the 14th of July. Jeff, thanks for the heads up on that. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, does Minnesota or Wisconsin have more lakes? Well, the answer depends on your definition of a lake. We'll talk with a researcher who started a project to define what makes a body of water a lake, a pond, or a wetland. Also, Wisconsin's dairy industry relies on workers from Mexico and Central America. We'll talk with the author of a new book about the state's workers, farmers, and the politics of immigration that surround the industry. All that and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we hear from a political scientist on today's January 6th hearings that presented new evidence about the collaboration between extremist groups and White House allies during the January 6th Capitol insurrection. I'm Dean Kinetter, in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Dean Kinetter, in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a recent study shows stress might age a person's immune system faster. We'll talk to a psychiatry professor about ways to reduce stress and protect our mental health. First, the January 6th committee met today for the seventh time to discuss new evidence regarding the attack on Congress on January 6th, 2021, as it certified Joe Biden's victory in the presidential election. The committee reviewed the impact of extremist groups like the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys in the Capitol insurrection. It also looked at the collaboration between those groups and allies of former President Donald Trump. We want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. What did you find surprising about today's hearing? Did you hear anything that makes you feel differently about the attack on the Capitol? What do you think still needs to be covered? What questions do you want to hear answered? And who do you want to hear from? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Susan Johnson is an associate professor of political science and assistant dean at the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater. Susan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Susan, today's hearing covered a lot of ground, from the internal politics at the White House to external groups like the Proud Boys. What stuck out to you about what we heard today?
Well, there was so much. I think big picture, what stuck out to me is what's been sticking out to me across all of these hearings is how consistently those who are presenting this information, the members of Congress, are relying considerably on Republicans and members of the Trump administration to make their case. And the primary goal this afternoon was to make the case that there was a certain level of coordination between the White House and White House aides and hangers-oners, I would say, for the Trump administration, and then some of these extremist groups. And I think that they painted a very clear picture in that regard.
One of the former Trump officials to recently agree to testify for the committee was a former White House counsel, Pat Cipollone. And we saw some of that testimony today on video. What role do you, or what is the significance, do you think, of him now contributing to this this committee's work?
Well, I think that when you have someone like Pat Cipollone, who had been the White House counsel, who is someone that would therefore have been very close to a lot of the discussions that were happening about the everything post-election through January 6th and then beyond, and not being willing to testify and then changing his mind and agreeing to sit down for the closed-door testimony, which we then were able to see some clips of today, I think it's one more person who can validate what we've been hearing has been going on. One of the points that they wanted to make was that he did not, in his testimony, did not contradict things that Cassidy Hutchinson had mentioned last week as far as what her experiences had been working with Mark Meadows. So I think he's an important witness. I think, again, just to point out that it's another person who was close to the administration, who's also a Republican, who is making these claims.
And as you said, a lot of the people that have testified, former Trump officials, were not testifying previously, were not speaking out about these things as they were happening. Does that speak to the committee having some success with its subpoena power?
I think that part of it perhaps we can attribute to its subpoena power, particularly given the fact that, as we know, Steve Bannon, who has refused the subpoena, is to go on trial next week for a contempt of Congress charge. I think that what we're seeing is that people who perhaps thought that this was going to go away, to not have as much impact, their initial reaction is to say they're not interested in participating. But then you get kind of a waterfall effect, and that as one person goes over and participates, then there's a greater, greater urgency perhaps to also participate. And then absolutely there's the threat of contempt charges.
And one of the timelines that the committee focused on very closely today was mid-December of 2020. On December 14th, President Biden was officially, in some ways, declared president by the electors around the country. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell acknowledged that. Then on December 18th, a group of lawyers and other folks, including General Michael Flynn, Sidney Powell, met with Trump at the White House, at first without any other White House officials there. Can you talk a bit more, Susan, about that meeting and why it's getting so much attention?
Yeah, I think it's really important for listeners to understand just how controlled the access is in the White House. And hearing today of what transpired with a group of people making their way into the Oval Office and speaking to the president without senior staff and others in the room, that just doesn't happen. And one of the accounts I read referred to this as one more example of a White House in chaos. And one of the things that came out today was the fact that when White House senior staff found out that this meeting was taking place, that there was just this mad rush for staff members to get into the room. And then there was apparently shouting and foul language being used and things of that sort, which is not necessarily how we expect things to go in the White House. And I think the key takeaway here is that this demonstrates that there were people in the White House who were very concerned about what potentially was being discussed or planned around resisting the lawful transition of power.
We're talking with Susan Johnson right now, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Whitewater, looking at today's January 6th committee hearing. Taking your calls as well at 800-642-1234. What stuck out to you today? What more do you want to hear? let us know. Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Susan, one of the things that happened in that meeting was, I believe, a draft executive order was brought to President Trump that outlined some fairly radical steps about how to preserve power and delay certification of results of the election. What stuck out to you about that?
Well, I think, honestly, at the most basic level, the fact that it was ever even drafted by anyone. And I think that these things shouldn't surprise me, but at a certain level, they still do. And the fact that there was this idea that the president could, by executive order, just say, you know, X, Y, and Z, it's still, again, it demonstrates just the lack of understanding of the democratic process, or maybe a lack of a willingness to accept the democratic process as it's out there. And it also speaks to what voices were most prominent around former President Trump at the time.
And shortly after that meeting, actually the next morning early, President Trump sent out a tweet saying that people could come to Washington on January 6th for a rally. It was going to be, quote, wild. And I think something we found out today was just the power of the bully pulpit and how much of an impact that tweet had online. Can you talk about the galvanizing effect of the president's words on Twitter?
Well, I mean, as we know, the president, former President Trump, used Twitter, many would argue, quite effectively to get his message out beyond what we traditionally expect the way a president would get his message out. And I think this was one of those examples where immediately after he tweeted, we began to see all kinds of responses to that tweet that demonstrated that people were taking his words to mean that there was going to be something very significant and potentially violent happening. And I think it's important to understand that that's the point that the members of Congress leading the hearings today were trying to get across, that there were people who were directly responding to that tweet and beginning to make plans and speak very violently about bringing handcuffs and, pepper spray and get ready to fight and all of that directly as direct responses to that tweet.
And Trump associates Robert Stone and General Michael Flynn were among the people who we found out had contact with the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys, a lot of these groups that had online sway and were responding to the president's words. What do we find out about their contacts with those groups?
Yeah, we heard that there were people, as you mentioned, like Roger Stone and others, who were in direct contact through encrypted forums and the like, in making plans, discussing what was going to happen on January 6th. And again, that's the point of what they're trying to get across in these hearings, is that you had these people very close to the president, people who were involved in a lot of those meetings at the White House, who were also engaging with the Proud Boys leader, Enrique Tarrio, and leaders of the Oath Keepers and others.
We're talking with Susan Johnson right now, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Whitewater. She's talking with us today about the evidence revealing the impact of extremist groups in the January 6th Capitol insurrection from today's committee hearing. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are you still hoping to learn about from these hearings? Have these hearings changed the way you're looking at the attack on the Capitol? What do you think needs to be investigated further? Who else do you want to hear from? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at WPR.org. The conversation continues coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Knetter. Right now, we're picking up the conversation with Susan Johnson, political science professor at UW-Whitewater. We're looking at today's January 6th committee hearing and new evidence that was presented. We're also taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Let's go to the calls now. Marcus is with us in Milwaukee. Hi, Marcus.
Hey, Dean. So my comments are this. I think that we need to understand, even though sometimes it may appear like there's two judicial systems in this country, we must understand that there is nobody who is above the law in this country. because otherwise our democracy is not going to work. The second thing is that the statement I was just following orders or instructions didn't work for the Nazis at Nuremberg and isn't going to work now. And so people need to understand that, you know, you got to think for yourselves because this is not acceptable and this will not allow, a house divided shall not stand.
Marcus, thanks for the call. Marcus there, I think, referring to the question of accountability for some in the White House and perhaps the president himself. Susan, what have we heard about the potential for anything beyond this committee in terms of criminal charges?
Well, as we've heard continually from the committee is that what their role would be is to refer information to the Justice Department and for potential criminal indictment. And what there's been a lot of pressure, I would say, from people who believe that the Justice Department, Attorney General Merrick Garland, they're not working quickly enough. And a lot of people on the left in particular, obviously, would like to see more quick action. I would point to some of the comments that Congresswoman Liz Cheney has made both during the hearings and then when she's been interviewed outside of the hearings in regard to the way she speaks about the illegality of some of the actions by President Trump and signaling, I believe, that there should be criminal consequences or penalties applied as high up as need be. And so I think that sometimes the wheels of justice turn slowly, and that's what we're seeing right now. But I think there's some significant urgency as well, and I'm hearing that from the caller.
Marcus, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go next to Saul in Stevens Point. Hi, Saul.
Hi, good afternoon. I had two brief comments and a question. The comments, Steve Cipollone, I thought, was a very reluctant and sort of a prissy witness. You know, he stepped around. He acted the lawyer, but he didn't show any kind of emotional involvement. So I don't know that they're going to get much out of him. I'll find out later. Secondly, I thought he was just basically shamed into it by Ms. McCutcheon. So second thing is they wasted a lot of time highlighting tweets and comments. Every pimply 17-year-old probably gets a big charge out of saying ridiculous things on the Internet. So it would have been more useful to use FBI evaluations of what the noise was on the Internet about this rather than just citing silly comments by people who are unidentified. The third is a question, and that is, are they going to get anything useful out of Steve Bannon? Or is he just, you know, he just using this as a way to get out of his indictment?
Saul, thanks for the call. Let's pick up on Saul's second point first there, Susan. A lot of attention today on tweets, like we mentioned, the kind of impact of the president's words. But that's different than tapes, comments from the president himself. What do you think the committee's aim was today in highlighting all of those, that online activity?
First of all, I agree with the comments that that the caller made as far as both of the two comments. I think that they were trying to demonstrate the cumulative effect of many, many, many tweets, many people putting out there that they believed that they were getting their marching orders from President Trump, and that therefore when people showed up on January 6th, that they were doing so because the president told them to. So I think the goal was to show the cumulative effect because there were so many.
And Saul also mentioned Steve Bannon, who agreed recently to cooperate with the January 6th committee. That could be an interesting witness. Susan, what are you watching out for with Steve Bannon's work with the committee?
There's a lot of people who are quite suspicious of Bannon's motives on a couple of different fronts. So first of all, there's the obvious one, which is he has a trial starting next week on contempt, and I hope that perhaps his participation would make that a moot point. The judge has already indicated that's not the case. The trial is going to move forward either way. A second thing that I've read is the concern that his willingness to testify would be a way for him to spout some of the misstatements and falsehoods and propaganda as a way to try to derail the hearings and get a lot of attention on him, because we know that that should he testify, that will quote unquote trump a lot of what we've already heard. And it will really get people, the media, I would say, to focus a lot on every word he says, and that will detract from the other work that the committee is doing.
Time for one more call. We'll go to Jeff in Superior. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, good afternoon. I, you know, used to be a Democrat. I voted for Democrats in the past. But I refuse to be brainwashed by what the Democratic Party is doing in these hearings. They held no hearings during the Black Lives Matter riots and Antifa damage that they did to our country. So these hearings are politically biased. I also believe President Trump had a responsibility to maintain, his executive branch power, because he was president till January 20th. Now, Hillary lost her popular vote. Gore lost her popular vote. So I know the Democrats had to cheat in the Electoral College. And we know that those ballot boxes in Madison were ruled illegal by the Wisconsin State Supreme Court. And there were other illegal votes counted and illegal ballots counted.
Jeff, I'm going to jump in there because the State Supreme Court ruling did clarify election guidance, but did not say that votes in Madison were fraudulent. But Susan, to Jeff's point of political bias and presidential power until the 20th, is it safe to say that what happened on the 6th goes a little bit beyond that?
Well, I don't think that anyone is questioning the fact that President Trump was president until President Biden was sworn in. I don't think that's up for debate. I think the issue being covered right now has to do with what role did President Trump have in inciting a riot, an insurrection at the Capitol. I don't think that they're mutually exclusive.
Sure. And two other people we heard today, witnesses today that we heard from Susan, were Stephen Ayers, who was at the Capitol on January 6th, and the former spokesperson for the Oath Keepers, Mr. Jason Van Tatenhove. Can you talk about what they brought to the hearings today?
Yeah, I think Mr. Ayers was put in front of the committee. He's someone who has been, he's going on trial for his participation in the event. And I think he put a face to the tweets, maybe, in the context that he explained why he was there and that he believed that he should come because Trump asked them to come. The court documents have shown that he put an image on Facebook saying that, taking a Twitter post from former President Trump and saying that's why he was going. So that's why he was there. And then as far as Mr. Van Tatenhove, his idea was to provide background on what the Oath Keepers really are, given that he had been involved in that organization as its spokesperson. So he could speak to the role that they play in, I guess, disrupting their role in being a disruptive organization.
Sure. And Susan, in our last 30 seconds or so, what are you watching for next? What are you hoping to hear?
Well, they gave us a prelude to what was going to be covered in the next hearing, and that's going to be how President Trump behaved actually while the insurrection was going on January 6th. So, I mean, I'll be curious to see what else is there. And I do want to hear more about what Cipollone has to say. And they did tease that a little bit as well as they were closing up today.
Well, I'm sure we'll talk again. Susan, thanks as always for joining us.
I'm happy to do it. Thank you for having me.
That was Susan Johnson, an associate professor of political science and assistant dean at the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater. She joined us today to talk about the January 6th committee hearing earlier this afternoon. Coming up after the news, a psychiatry professor joins us to look at the negative health impacts of stress and the ways to reduce stress in our lives. I'm Dean Kinetter, in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.